Well, this morning we are continuing in our series, The Greatest Sermon Ever Preached. But if I'm honest, I think the world around us probably wouldn't agree with that assessment by this time. Because for the world around us, they'd probably like a little more patting on the back, and a little less challenging, a little more, you're doing great, just keep trying, and a little less of Jesus raising the bar of expectations so darn high. Because as we've seen, these last couple weeks especially, Jesus has a very high set of expectations for his followers. That if you're going to be a disciple of Christ, if you're going to be a follower of Christ, if you're going to belong to his kingdom, then he's got a high calling on your life. And so the last 2 weeks especially, Jesus had called out those who believe that simply outward actions are good enough and really went after the heart. So 2 weeks ago it was, those who think that simply not murdering is good enough, I tell you, you can't even be angry with your brother. And those of you who think just not committing adultery is good enough, I tell you that even a lustful look is sinful. And so Jesus just keeps raising this bar higher and higher. Keeps saying the actions aren't enough, it's about the heart. And this morning, the next topic that Jesus addresses in this set of six statements in a row in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount is frankly, no easier to discuss than the last two. For the topic that Jesus hits next is divorce. And I think that what we'll find today is that so much of our opinion, so much of our focus when we come to this topic of divorce is driven by the question we ask as we talk about divorce. It's driven by the question that we ask, even if we don't ask it knowingly, even if we don't ask it out loud. It's about the question that lies behind our discussion of divorce. Albert Einstein once said, "If I had an hour to solve a problem and my life depended on it, I would use the first 55 minutes determining the proper question to ask." Or, if you want something a little more modern, in The Matrix, right, it's all about the question that drives us, Neo. It's the question. You know the question. And sometimes it's the question that is more telling about our opinions and what we're thinking than the actual answer that we give, because the question shows us our frame of mind. I think we'll find the same issue applies today, that the problem we're faced with in our text, and obviously in the world all around us, the problem that we face is divorce. But now as Christians, we need to first think about what's the proper question to ask when we talk about divorce. Because sometimes the questions that we ask make all the difference. Before we get into the text this morning, and into Jesus' teaching on divorce, I have a caution. A caution to us all as we read this text in particular, but frankly, a very common caution when reading and interpreting the Bible at all. In seminary, amongst the nerdiest of us nerds, we would say, "What's the cry of the exegete? Context, context, context." Right? Or you can say it like, there's three rules in real estate, right? Location, location, location. There's three rules in exegeting and reading and interpreting scripture, and the three rules are context, context, context. And this is my caution for us this morning, immediately, before we ever even get to read a word from scripture, is context, context, context. That we have to be careful that what we take here, that we take it in its context. So first we have to make sure that we don't act as if this is Jesus' treatise on divorce and therefore contains all of his thoughts on the topic. It can be easy for us sometimes to act as if Jesus wrote a research paper on the topic of divorce or, or maybe gave an hour-long lecture on divorce where he divulged everything that we need to know about the topic. But let's be honest, Jesus never does anything like that on any topic. Right? Think about the ways that Jesus normally teaches. He teaches with a parable here, a story there. He teaches with some sort of image. Right? He's often teaching, sometimes even in sort of poetic language. Think about the Beatitudes. Really, that's a form of poetry. That really I can't think of a single time in which Jesus gives a teaching that we would consider to be comprehensive or complete, where he actually plainly and straightforwardly speaks on a topic and says everything that he thinks on that topic. 80% of his teaching in the gospel seems to be in parables, or at least in some way that the disciples afterwards come back and are like, hey, we didn't get any of that. Can you explain it in like a little bit dumber terms? Right? Jesus is never giving these comprehensive treatises on topics where he covers everything there is to possibly know about a topic. I mean, consider that this is the greatest sermon that Jesus preaches in his life. And we get two verses total on the topic of divorce. Or consider for a minute the passage that we just discussed on anger. Right? When he talked about anger, he doesn't give us a treatise. He doesn't talk about, this is what anger is. This is how anger is sinful and not sinful. This is, though, the category of righteous anger. This is the gray area of anger, and this is the anger that's just bad. Instead, what Jesus said is he just gave us a complete blanket statement that when you're angry with your brother, you sin. Is that clearly Jesus' entire opinion on anger? Surely not. Surely Jesus understood the idea of righteous anger. After all, he became angry at times, and we know he didn't sin. So even if we just think back a couple verses, we'd say when he was talking about anger, he still didn't say everything there was to be said on anger. Instead, Jesus uses hyperboles. He uses at times exaggeration to get his point across to say, this is how important a topic is. So that is my first caution for us this morning, that we don't act as if the few words spoken here are a comprehensive treatment of this topic of divorce from a Christian perspective. That's my first call to us in context. I have a second call to us in context in relation to our caution for the day. It is this: to recognize that Jesus is speaking to a specific group of people at a specific time. And as a result, some of what he says needs to be understood and interpreted in light of the cultural differences. Also, we need to realize that there are some things that Jesus may have left unsaid that would have immediately been understood by his audience. Divorce amongst the Jewish people in the first century both had some differences, as well as, of course, some similarities to divorce today. So we'll need to consider these questions as we talk about divorce today. So those are my cautions for us. Context, context, context. We can't assume that the few words that we have here are complete treatment of everything that Jesus thought about divorce. And second, we got to realize he was speaking to a specific people at a specific point in time who had specific ideas and views and preconceptions about divorce. So that is our caution for today. Now a confession by me. I'm going to cheat. I'm absolutely going to cheat this morning. How am I going to cheat? I'm going to read Matthew 5, 31 and 32, and then I'm going to preach from an entirely different passage. Well, that doesn't seem right. Well, too bad. Let me tell you why, though. Let me tell you why I'm going to cheat this morning. Why? Because I think that what Jesus is doing here is seen even clearer in another passage. A very closely related passage, a longer passage, and one that is still found in the book of Matthew. And the other passage is going to contain everything that's spoken here and give us some more as well, which you'll see. So, you know, it's almost like looking up the answers in the back of the book. We're going to page 19 to find the answers for the crossword on page 5. This happens to be chapter 19 instead of chapter 5. So here we go. Matthew 5, 31 and 32. And here is everything that Jesus says on divorce in the Sermon on the Mount. It was also said, there's sort of the beginning of our antithesis, right? We have these six antitheses. You've heard that it was said. This time it's a little bit shorter. Seems to connect it to the material directly before it, which will make sense. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So a couple general observations before we cheat and just go to a different chapter and verse. First, of course, we have our typical antithesis. Instead of this time it was you've heard it was said, now it's simply it was also said. One of the things that this does is it clearly links this to the material directly before it in a way that the others don't. Before it was you've heard it was said, you've heard it was said, and coming later again, you've heard that it was said. This one says, and it was also said. Why would it be connected directly to the material before it? Well, there's a pretty obvious reason. In the material before it, he was talking about how lust is essentially another form of adultery. In this passage, he talks about divorce and adultery. So there's a clear connection between this and the lust passage before it. It was also said, but I say to you. So we still have, this is antithesis number three of the six antitheses. The same structure and a very natural flow of topics here, moving from lust and even a lustful thought, a lustful look, is as if you have already committed adultery with her in your heart. And here divorce, and he who marries a divorced woman commits adultery, and so you have these adultery ideas back to back. Those are my observations on 531 to 32. There's far more to be said about this, but let's turn to Matthew chapter 19 instead. I promise, we're still looking at the same topic. And you will see that those two verses, you've heard that it was also said, and that give a certificate of divorce, etc., that's going to appear in our passage. And then Jesus' second part, whoever divorces a woman except for sexual immorality, that will also appear in this. I promise, we'll hit those two topics as we look at Matthew 19, beginning in verse 3. What we have in Matthew 19 is the longest passage on divorce in all the Gospels. Might not be true. Maybe Mark 10 is a little bit longer. Would it shock you to know that there are a total of four teachings on divorce in all of the Gospels combined? We just looked at one of the four. Luke 16, 18, equally as short. We have and that's the only passage in Luke. We have one passage in Mark that is the direct parallel of the passage we're about to read. We have this passage in Matthew. And in John, it's not even a passage on divorce. Surprising that so little actually seems to be said on the passage in the Gospels. But here we have, in Matthew 19, we have this topic of divorce introduced by the Pharisees. In verse 3, let's begin. And Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? There's a lot going on in this little verse. The Pharisees come to him and it says they tested him by asking him this question. How is it that the Pharisees tested him in asking him a question about divorce? Two ways. Way number one is, if you know your gospel history, then you know that John the Baptist got himself in trouble for one thing in particular. It was for what? It was for speaking out against divorce, specifically against the ruler of the Jewish people at this time, Herod. You have a leader named Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas had a brother named Philip. His brother Philip was married to a gal who is referred to as Herodias in the Bible, not to be confused with Herod. Herodias is a lady, and Herod's brother Philip married to Herodias. Herodias decides to leave, divorce Philip in order to marry Philip's brother Herod. So Herod has his brother and his brother's wife sort of get divorced so that he can marry what was his sister-in-law, now becomes his wife. John the Baptist wasn't cool with that, spoke out against it, and we know John the Baptist's faith, prison to beheading. So when it says the Pharisees came to test him, sometimes use the word trap here, they come to test him, to trap him by asking, hey, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? Because at this point in time, he's in the region of Perea, which is the region which Herod rules over. So one of the ideas here is, yeah, if they can get him to speak out against divorce, maybe Herod will throw him in prison and chop off his head too. Right? That's Pharisee trap number one. But there's a second trap going on here, and it's found in these last words. And Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, is it lawful to divorce one's wife? These final three words are key. For any cause. Here is the second way in which this is a test or a trap. Again, context, context, context. What we know is at this time in the first century Judaism, there were different rabbis, right? You would have different rabbis, and those rabbis would sort of have their entire schools of thought. There were two famous rabbis who talked about the topic of divorce, Rabbi Hillel and Rabbi Shammai. And the discussion was all about this, these three words. Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? The reason being that there's a passage, which we'll refer to in a little bit, in Deuteronomy 24, which talks about giving a wife a certificate of divorce. And the passage says, if there is some indecency found in her, then you give her a certificate of divorce and send her away. Well, the rabbis, as always, took a very close inspection of the words. Rabbi Shammai said, the word indecency there in that passage refers to some sexual immorality. And so Rabbi Shammai took a strong stance and said, you can only get divorced if there's sexual immorality involved. Rabbi Hillel, on the other hand, decided to put a lot more emphasis on the word some than on the word indecency. And so he took it like this. Well, if you can find some indecency in her, then you could divorce her, which meant for any cause. And the famous reference that we actually have in his work is burning the food. If your wife burns the food one too many times, that is some indecency, and therefore give her a certificate of divorce and send her away. Another rabbi at the time said, and it goes so far as to, if a prettier woman catches your eye, then you have found some indecency in your current wife, and so you can go after the prettier one. So this is the debate that's raging at the time in the first century when Jesus is speaking. Now you can see how this is a second test. So the Pharisees' first way of testing him is, if we can get him to say something that Herod doesn't like, maybe he'll behead him. The second test is, well, the Jewish people at the time were divided between these two schools. So it's kind of like, oh, and if, by the way, unsurprisingly, then, like today, it seems that Rabbi Hillel, the, if you see a prettier woman, feel free to divorce your wife, it seems that his school of thought was more popular, right? Not shockingly. And so on the other hand, the Pharisees are saying, hey, if we can get Jesus to take a stance here on one of these two, he will alienate a big group of his followers, and either those who follow Rabbi Shammai or Rabbi Hillel, or at least have that frame of thought, will now leave Jesus, he'll become unpopular, people won't like him anymore. So that's what's going on here when it says the Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? So what do they want? They want for Jesus to come down on one side or the other, right? They want him to either tick off Herod and maybe die, or tick off some of the Jewish people and in this way lose some followers, become less popular. So that's the first piece of historical information we need to know. Let's talk a little bit more about the historical background of divorce in general. Because still there's more going on here. That's the debate raging in divorce. But what we still don't know is some of the cultural norms for divorce. As soon as I say, is it lawful to divorce? In our mind, we have a certain set of assumptions about what divorce is and what it means and what the expectations are around it, as opposed to what they would have had in the first century. Cultural issues here. Number one, that in amongst the Jews, only men could divorce their wives. A wife could not divorce the husband. You can glance to verse 9 here. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, right? It's intentional that it's divorces his wife and not whoever divorces one spouse. Whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another commits adultery. Because only in the Jewish nation, only the husband could divorce the wife. On the other hand, amongst the Greeks, wives could divorce their husbands as well. It's why if you look in Mark at the parallel, it says, and if a wife divorces her husband, because Mark has a far more widespread Roman audience, right? So amongst the Jews, only husbands can divorce their wives. We'll also play a factor later as we consider that topic. The process of divorce. Divorce required no legal hearing. You didn't go to courts to get divorced. As we'll see later, and as we've already read, there was such a thing as a certificate of divorce. We'll talk about its part later. But divorce required no legal hearing. It was essentially then, especially in Jewish circles, it was just the husband's decision. Husband could wake up one day, especially if they followed Rabbi Hillel, could wake up one day, decided he had found some indecency in his wife, and walk into the room and say, I'm sorry, I'm divorcing you, and you're out. And she was expected simply to leave. So divorce required no legal hearing, merely the husband's decision. The third important thing here when it comes to cultural issues is regarding divorce and remarriage. Divorce was not seen, as it is today, was not seen as a way to become single, but always occurred with the express intention of remarrying. Right? That there is an underlying cultural assumption that as soon as they read the word divorce, there is an assumption that it is for the purpose of remarriage, and that remarriage will happen. Right? This idea of living single, right, bachelorhood throughout life, or of divorcing for the purpose of just getting to live alone again, or continuing to live alone, really wouldn't have occurred to people in the first century. If you got divorced, you were going to get remarried. You didn't get divorced and then live single. It seems, however, that there were some exceptions, but this is how we know it's an exception to the rule, because it's pointed out at times when a woman gets divorced and decides to stay single. We never see references to men getting divorced and not remarrying. So even when they see the word divorce, there's no thought here that they would get divorced and then stay single. Divorce had the purpose of, was pointed towards, remarriage. For both the husband and the wife, there was an assumption that once divorced, they would remarry, which is why the certificate of divorce comes into play. So divorce and remarriage, there's an assumption here, a cultural assumption, that as soon as you see divorce, they're going to get remarried. It's not divorcing for the sake of being single. Next cultural issue. Both Jewish and Roman law actually mandated divorce in the case of sexual unfaithfulness in marriage, specifically adultery. If there was adultery, both Roman law and Jewish law required divorce. Now, frankly, Jewish law required death for adultery, but it seems by the time we get to the first century that that was no longer practiced. So both Jewish and Roman law mandated divorce if there was a case of adultery. The reason being that the act of sexual immorality had already inseparably it had already just completely nullified the marriage. There is irreparable damage done. And the act of adultery was a breaking of the marriage covenant, and therefore the marriage was essentially null and void. Therefore, if there was adultery in the first century, it mandated, Jewish and Roman law both mandated it. So there are all the cultural things going on behind this little question. One, you got to understand that when they come to test him, it's because they either want Herod to kill him or they want the Jewish people to turn against him. Number two, you got to realize all these background topics, right? That only Jewish men could divorce their wives, while the Gentiles, wives could also divorce their husbands. Now, the process of divorce was simply a husband walking up to the wife and saying, "I divorce thee. Thou hast been divorced." And it was over, right? And that divorce, however, was always seen with the idea of remarriage in the immediate future. Now, let's get back to the Pharisees' question. Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? We've talked about it being a test. Now let's actually diagnose the question itself. What is at the heart of this question? What does this question imply? The heart of this question is this: when can we get divorced? So when exactly can we get divorced? There's a few obvious things about this question. Number one, it assumes that divorce will happen. It really assumes that divorce will happen. It assumes divorce. Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? But it really assumes that divorce will happen. Secondly, it looks for justification of when it's okay. So when is it okay for us to get divorced? Is it only okay in sexual immorality, or is it okay also for any cause? The question itself assumes divorce, and it's looking for justification. It's looking to justify divorce. And the majority of Jews would have seemed to be nodding their heads along, saying that they really favored Rabbi Hillel, the burnt toast guy. The no-fault divorce. And the majority of Jews around them were like, yeah, I want to know the answer to this question too. When do I get to get divorced? I think we ask the same question today, or at least not maybe us personally, but this is the question asked around us. Yeah, when is it okay to get divorced? Can I get divorced if ... Or after the fact, well, should my uncle have gotten divorced? This was the scenario. Should I recommend to my friend that he or she gets a divorce when this is what's going on? I imagine that some, if not many of you, have had a talk like this with some friend or family member. Someone looking to get out of their marriage, looking to justify it, and asking the question, so when is it okay? Is it okay here? Can I justify it? Am I in the clear? Don't you know this is happening too, so now it's okay, right? But I think that the Pharisees, and I think that we today, that we're simply asking the wrong question. This is the wrong question to be asking. That if Einstein spent an hour thinking about this topic, and he spent the first 55 minutes thinking about what question to ask, this is the wrong question. And this is how Jesus responds. That you're asking the wrong question altogether. You're asking the wrong question, Pharisees. Matthew 19, verses 4 through 6. He answered, and what would you expect him to answer? And he answered, no, it's not right to get divorced for any cause. Or yes, it is right. No, it's not right to get divorced for any cause, only adultery. But how does Jesus answer them? Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. Jesus says, look, you're asking the wrong question altogether. You're asking, when can we get divorced? You're assuming divorce. You're looking for justification for divorce. This is the wrong fundamental question to be asking. Right? Instead of assuming sin and brokenness and divorce, instead of assuming that these things can and should happen at times, instead of asking, when can we get divorced, Jesus tells us the question we should be asking. He goes straight back to creation. He says the question we should be asking is, what is God's ideal for marriage? What is God's creative design for marriage? This is the question that Jesus answers, and therefore I think is the question that he's telling us to ask. He says, look, from the beginning, he created the male and female, and they leave and they cleave, and the two become one. And what God then has joined together, let not man separate. Because this is God's intent. It's God's design. It's God's creative design for what marriage is meant to be. God made it this way. Who are we to change it? Notice he says, what therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. So even in this statement, he's saying, yeah, it's possible for you to undo it. I think this is Jesus' way of saying, yeah, you know, when divorce happens, you have indeed separated what God joined together. And what an idiotic idea that you would undo something that God has done. This is the way that Jesus wants us to think. Don't start with the assumption that divorce is okay at times even. Don't start with the assumption that divorce is going to happen. You say, well, I'm just being realistic. Well, whatever. What Jesus says is, no, the way that you ought to think, the very questions that you should be asking aren't, when is it okay? The questions you should be asking are, what is God's design? What is God's ideal for marriage? And when that's your question, the answer is obvious. God brought it together. Let not man separate. We can't keep asking the wrong questions. Stop assuming divorce. Stop asking the wrong questions. But the Pharisees, they continue. At times, when I read this passage, I think of them like a little child, excusing their behavior with saying something like this, but Dad said that I could. Because this is exactly what they do. It's just, but Moses said we could. Verse 7, they said to him, why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away? Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away? I'll flip back to Matthew 5:31. It was also said, Jesus says, it was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. What's interesting here is when Jesus gave the last two antitheses, right? He said, you've heard that it was said, you shall not murder. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Those were direct quotes from God, from the Old Testament law. This one, however, is not. This one is not. There is no command in the Old Testament law. In fact, there is no passage in the Old Testament law that says, divorce a woman by giving her a certificate of divorce. What we do have is in Deuteronomy 24, it's talking about a very specific situation, a situation where someone is divorced from a woman. That woman goes and marries another guy. That guy divorces her, and then the original husband isn't allowed to remarry her. And in the midst of that scenario, it speaks about when the first husband divorces her and gives her a certificate of divorce, and then when the second husband divorces her and gives her a certificate of divorce, then the husband can't remarry her. So what we have is sort of an implication. It's an inference from the passage in Deuteronomy 24 that there is such a thing as a certificate of divorce, and that it must have been sort of a design of Moses, which I agree. But notice that there's a little difference here. One, it's not a direct quote. It's not something that God gave to the people of Israel, like he gave the Mosaic Law. Number two, notice that when in Matthew 19, the Pharisees say, why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce? It's kind of shady language, as if Moses is commanding them to go ahead and divorce people when things go wrong. However, what it does seem is going on here, what is the certificate of divorce, we should ask? What is the certificate of divorce? What's going on here? The certificate of divorce, where did it come from? It truly seems to have come from Moses. Fully do believe that Moses then went ahead and created this idea of a certificate of divorce. Why? Why is because it really was for the protection of the woman. It was for the protection of the wife. Right? What we've said about divorce is that basically a husband can walk up and just be like, yeah, done with you. Well, think about it then. One, there's a very easy, it would be very easy then for husbands to really take advantage of that situation, to constantly threaten with divorce, or even to sort of divorce her in the morning and take her back at night. To use it as a manipulative, as a manipulative thing. So number one, it sort of protects them in that way. Number two, imagine if you place yourself now back in the Old Testament times, and if the true way of divorcing someone was for a husband simply to say to the wife, you're divorced, go out, then that woman needs to go and they'll probably immediately return to their families if possible, but then they also want to look for another marriage, right? Wives needed marriages in the Old Testament just to have a home, a livelihood, to be able to survive. And so the problem was then if you were a wife and if all it was a verbal, the husband just says you're divorced and you walk around, you go out and you go to people and try to let them know you're divorced, then people would not have had any way to know if you truly were divorced or not. In which case, guys may have been really suspect of a woman just showing up and saying, oh no, my husband divorced me. Are you interested? Right? There was no way to have a way of knowing if you were safe. In this case, the certificate of divorce is a protection for the wife. Then the wife says, no, I have a certificate of divorce. I am free to remarry. I am free to go look. I'm free to go around. I'm no longer bound by this. And so in a way, it was really a protective thing for the wife to free them up for everybody to see and to know that they were free to remarry. That's what the certificate of divorce seems to have as its purpose then. It was a good thing, a protection on the wife. However, you know, it seems then that what the Pharisees, what the Jewish people were doing was saying, oh, look, it seems that all we got to do is sort of write up a certificate. We could divorce whenever we want. And then the Pharisees are here saying, well, you know, you're trying to say that God designed marriage to be eternal, you know, that it was really permanent, but Moses allowed us to, and so that's successive revelation, you know, as Moses was sort of the mouthpiece of God and he allowed it. So I think probably that whole original design and intent for marriage maybe doesn't apply anymore. Because Moses allows us, you know, even commands us to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away. And this is just the way that the Pharisees think. Again, it's looking for excuses. It's looking for justification. It's looking for ways out. Or well, as long as we give a certificate, then we're doing the woman a favor by giving her the certificate and divorcing her. So shouldn't that make it fine? Shouldn't then it be okay? Well, sure, God created marriage, but then the greatest leader of Israel, the one who brought us out of Egypt, he said divorce is all right. And look at how kindly we do this divorce thing now. It's so friendly. A handshake and a document. And I even use my good pen to sign it. And then Jesus' response. He said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. Jesus looks at him and says, yeah, sure, Moses allowed you to divorce, But why? Because of your hard hearts. Because of your sin. Because divorce is always the result of sin. Always the result of sin. Never a scenario in which divorce cannot be the result of sin. It says, look, it's, yeah, because of your hard hearts, Moses allowed it. But from the beginning, it was not so. Or from the beginning of all time, from the beginning. And as soon as you read from the beginning, you have to think God himself. And from the beginning, it was not so. This was not God's design, not God's creative intent for marriage, not God's ideal ever. And so Jesus says, yeah, you know, sure, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but only because of your hardness of heart. Right? You want to say, well, no, the way we do it now, it's kind, it's soft-hearted. You're looking for ways out. It's all just a result of your sin. And that's asking the wrong questions. Right? When is it okay to divorce? Well, why did Moses allow us to divorce? These questions assume divorce. They assume the worst. And Jesus says, no, you got to change the way you think about it. Because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, shouldn't that sound familiar? And I say to you, and sure enough, it's almost directly quoted from 5:32, almost the exact same words. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. Whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. We have a couple interesting parts of this statement. Number one, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. Again, this idea of committing adultery, which has got to take you right back to whoever looks on a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery in her with his heart. It's interesting that another one of the passages in the Gospels on this says that as soon as you divorce your wife, you have made them commit adultery. Which is interesting because it seems from the other verse that it's almost as if the very act of divorcing commits adultery. Whoever divorces his wife, and now we have the exception clause, as it's called, except for sexual immorality. Turn with me real quick to Luke 16, 18. Luke 16, 18. You'll notice a difference here. Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. What do we not have in Luke 16, 18? We have no exception clause. Interesting that Luke would not include the exception clause, whereas Matthew does. Let's flip back and consider this exception clause. What does it mean, except for sexual immorality? Number one, what do we mean by sexual immorality? It's the Greek word porneia, from which, of course, we get the word porn, pornography. Porneia, it's this generic word for any sexual immorality. It doesn't necessarily refer to adultery then, but, of course, adultery would fall under the category. So whoever divorces wife except for sexual immorality. The natural question that follows then is this. Is sexual immorality the only time when divorce is acceptable before God? Is it not acceptable before God if one gets divorced due to, say, physical or emotional abuse? What about when one person walks away from the Lord? Are you supposed to just separate without ever actually getting divorced, as some have taken this passage to mean? Well, it's okay before God's eyes if you separate, but you're not really divorced if, you know, there's abuse going on. Because the only reason that you're allowed to get divorced is for sexual immorality. Is that what this exception clause means? That the only legitimate grounds for divorce is if there's been sexual immorality? Well, let's remind ourselves of my caution at the beginning. Number one, we have to be careful that we take this in context. Make sure that we don't act as if this is Jesus' treatise on divorce and therefore contains all of his thoughts on the topic. Jesus never talks this way. And consider for a minute his passage on anger. He said, however, if you get angry at your brother, you sin. Notice there was no exception clause there. Does that mean that there were no exceptions? Just as with the anger passage, I think even though Jesus doesn't say, except for righteous anger, doesn't mean that Jesus couldn't see a scenario in which anger might be justified. And just because he gives an exception here, doesn't mean that there aren't other exceptions. For instance, in Luke, there were no exceptions given at all. However, surely, there are some exceptions. So as we continue to think, well, is this the only time when divorce is acceptable before God? Let's consider the testimony in Mark 10:12 and Luke 16:18. Neither of them has an exception clause at all. Does that mean that if you had the book of Mark and you didn't have the book of Matthew, that you would believe there were no exceptions at all? I think I'm going to make the argument that Jesus is not giving us his complete thoughts here. He's not telling us every scenario in which it is morally acceptable to get divorced. There's a quote by, I'll give you two quotes, by some great thinkers of our day. The first from Craig Blomberg. He says, the specific historical background that informed this debate, the particular way in which the question is phrased, and the unscrupulous motives behind the Pharisees' approach all warn us against the notion that Jesus was comprehensively addressing all relevant questions about marriage and divorce. For example, the problem of wife beating would not even be considered, since a man would scarcely divorce his wife for that reason. D.A. Carson says, Jesus' purpose in these two verses, in Matthew 5, was not to explain every detail regarding divorce and remarriage, but to help people think differently about his law, to help them begin to see the heart intention behind the letter. So I'm going to say, no, this isn't the only situation, and I feel very comfortable saying that, frankly, because of the Apostle Paul, because I'm not the only one saying. Because Paul actually gives a second exception. He gives a second exception in 1 Corinthians 7:15 that he actually says that another permissible time for divorce was when a believer was essentially deserted by an unbeliever. The specific scenario isn't as important as the fact that clearly Paul believed there were other reasons outside of just sexual immorality when divorce was allowable, permissible. So abuse, neglect, are these legitimate grounds for a Christian divorce? In some cases, yes, I think they probably are. But notice the fundamental flaw, even with our conversation in the last 5 minutes, that as soon as we start to ask these questions, we fall into the very same trap that the Pharisees were in. We're now asking for a list. When is it okay to divorce? But is that the question that Jesus wants us to ask? It seems no. Those, can I get out yet? Is this justified? That as soon as we ask the question, when is it okay to divorce? That I think that Jesus immediately wants us to give the answer, never. It's never okay to divorce. Because divorce isn't God's intent. It's not God's ideal. It's not God's creative intent. And that's the way Jesus wants us to think about the topic, that divorce itself is always a result of sin. And yet, will divorce happen around us? Yes, of course it will. Because we do live in a sin-filled, broken world. But we just don't want to be like the Pharisees. Those who are always asking and looking for an out. We want to recognize, as the book of Malachi tells us, simply that God hates divorce. And what we should be asking is this: how can we always seek reconciliation in our marriages and the marriages around us? But maybe if we'd worry a little bit less about the answer to the question, when is it okay to divorce, and worry more about asking the right questions. What is God's ideal for marriage? How did God design marriages to be? And what can we do? What can we do to seek reconciliation in our own marriages and in the marriages around us that are hurting and broken? And I think that's a question, and that is a way of thinking about marriage in a way that glorifies God. Instead of simply asking, is it lawful to divorce a wife for any cause? And assuming the sin of divorce. Let's pray. Father God, we just recognize that we live in a sinful and broken world. That while divorce was never your intention, that in the grim reality in which we live, that divorce will happen. That it does happen around us and to us. But God, we just don't want to think about divorce in this way. We don't want to be people who look to justify something like divorce. So Lord, help us to be people who ask the better question about what is your ideal for marriage, and then who pursue that in our own marriages and pursue that in the marriages around us, people who are broken and hurting, that wherever we may be in our lives now, that we would pursue a healthy, loving, permanent relationship with our spouses. Lord, for those who are single, that have married and hurting friends around them, that they too would see their role in changing the way that people think about divorce and in helping others pursue your creative intent in marriage. So Lord, help us to be people who take your law and your commands seriously, who see that you hate divorce, that it is a serious, sinful offense before you, that it is something that you have created, that in the marriage ceremony you join people together, and God, we never want to be opposed to something that you have done and called good. It's in the Son's name that we pray. Amen.